came to America when he was 6 months old. He started as a stock boy at the grocery store. Eventually, he owned it. He turned it into the biggest grocery store chain in New York City. He now owns a real estate company worth over $2 billion. He ran for mayor of New York City. He almost won. You can't make this story up. This is the Katz Roundtable with John Catsimatidis.
Everywhere around the world, they come to America.
Good morning, America. This is the Katz Roundtable. John Catsimatidis here, Sunday morning. One great show for you today. We have Frank Pallone on a new bipartisan measure to save AM radio. Dr. Peter Michalos, how are we going to get to the age of 100? Steve Cates, what's going on up there in those skies? Andrew Stutterford on EV vehicles. Steve Forbes, the economy, what is happening? Bob Pacopo, nuclear modular reactors coming to the United States will replace oil over the next 20 to 30 years. Let's start off with General David Petraeus. What's going on in Israel and the Ukraine? With us today is General David Petraeus, retired four-star general, head of the CIA. He was in charge of the U.S. Central Command and NATO of U.S. forces in Afghanistan. General?
Yeah, the latest development, of course, is that Israel retaliated for the unprecedented attack directly from Iranian soil for the first time ever. Well over 300 missiles and drones, which also included some of those from Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, Shia militia in Syria, and the Houthis in Yemen. As you'll recall, that defensive operation knocked down 99% of those. There was very little damage, only one casualty reported. So really a spectacular defensive effort in which the U.S. contributed, knocking down probably about a third of those projectiles that were headed to Israel. Other countries in the region helped out as well. So, again, a very impressive performance. But the Israeli leadership felt that they needed to have some retaliation against something that was unprecedented. And that took place this past Friday morning, if you will, their time. It appears to have been a missile aimed at a military base outside Isfahan. This is significant because that's a base at which the most advanced fighters of Iran are based. They're not very advanced, I should note. They're old F-14s from the United States of many decades ago. But with the embargo, they can't replace those. More importantly, Isfahan is the site of several of the nuclear facilities that Iran has, not the major ones, but important ones. And so the symbolism of the Israelis being able to get through the air defenses and actually hit this base is quite significant. It's possible that they also launched in Iran, where there were reports that either drones or other projectiles were shot down. And there were also attacks on some bases in Syria that may or may not have been part of this retaliation. Now, what's important here is that, as you recall, Washington, Paris, and London really wanted Israel just to take the win. In other words, say, look, this extraordinary success of the coordinated air and ballistic missile defense effort was so significant in and of itself that that's the victory. Don't need to do more. But of course, those three capitals are more worried about the price of Brent crude that could go up if in some reason the retaliation further and had an effect on the price of oil and gas being restricted from the Gulf.
With all these things happening, Iran has now said that enough is enough. You know, we went after you, you went after us, and we think it's all over. Is it all over?
Well, it's certainly not all over in the long term, but this particular episode appears to have concluded. In the meantime, again, their proxies from Lebanon, Syria, even Iraq, and Yemen are going to continue to cause problems for Israel. But they seem to be somewhat measured. For example, Hezbollah has to do something every day out of sympathy for her brothers in Gaza and Hamas. But it's limited, both in geography and in terms of numbers. It does not appear that they want to get into another fight like they did in 2006, when they really got hammered in return. And they're still in some ways rebuilding from that particular war. on the other hand, the Israelis want to push them further north, north of the Litani River, which is 10 to 15-ish kilometers, which would take their shorter-range rockets out of the launch basket that where they could meaningfully get into Israel. Because keep in mind, there's tens of thousands of Israelis, civilians, who have been evacuated from northern Israel, just as there have been tens of thousands evacuated from the south still in the wake of the horrific 10-7 attacks.
Any predictions or any feelings what the Israelis are going to do with the rest of Gaza? Are they going
to
continue their...
Yeah, I think they have to, and I think they feel that they have to. And, of course, I was in Israel about a month ago. I've had exchanges with a member of the War Cabinet since then, including this early, very early on Monday morning. As Benny Gantz, former Minister of Defense, former general, has said, I think accurately, you don't send the fire department to extinguish 80% of the blaze. There are four battalions at least out of the 24 Hamas battalions that have not yet been destroyed. So they have to go into the south. They have to go into Rafah. But the question is how to do that, given that there's 1.1 million displaced Gaza residents down there, and they'll have to move those out of the way. And they're having a lot of dialogue with the U.S. national security team on this issue. The U.S. very concerned that there could be more innocent loss of life, even more of a humanitarian crisis than is already the case. And I know that the Israelis are working on how they can ramp up delivery of humanitarian assistance and also working their way through how they can do clear hold and build operations rather than just clear and move on. But that requires a substantial number of troops, and they really don't have that many inside Gaza at this point in time. They pulled a large number out, presumably resting and refitting and training for this follow-on operation in southern Gaza. And then they're going to have to come to grips with how do you keep Hamas from reconstituting in the areas that have been cleared but have not been, if you will, held. In other words, if they clear and they move on to another area. And we saw an example of this pretty substantially in the case of the Al-Shifa Hospital, which was cleared very publicly many months ago. And then they had to go back in recent weeks to clear out hundreds of Hamas fighters who had actually re-infiltrated. And that's going to be the problem going forward, coming to grips with that without having a huge density of forces and without creating, as we say, gated communities. There's a variety of tactics, techniques, and procedures that we learned how to do and implemented during the surge in Iraq, which, as you recall, I was privileged to command. So in this case, they've got to take a page, I think, out of what we learned out of our book on counterinsurgency, because once the battalions are no longer really functioning as units, they are still insurgents, guerrillas, terrorists, et cetera, that have to be dealt with. And yeah, so that's going to be something
to fight,
they will have to come to grips.
It's tough to fight a guerrilla operation.
It's very tough, especially in this situation, which is the most fiendishly difficult urban operation since the end of World War II, without question.
One last question. We've got about a minute left. Want to spend a minute on the Ukraine? What's the situation?
Well, I was just there 2 weeks ago. I spent 4 days actually in Kyiv, met with all the leaders. The situation, I think, is more dire than people realize. The stall in the U.S. House of Representatives that has prevented really almost 6 months now, the kind of industrial strength provision of heavy artillery rounds, of air defense systems and interceptors, all of the very desperately needed items, has really put Ukraine in a tough spot. They are right now, for example, shooting one round for every eight or so that the Russians are shooting. And the Russians have been learning, unfortunately, and they've pioneered some new tactics, including glide bombs that are launched as much as 70 kilometers behind the front lines that are just hammering the positions defended by the Ukrainians and in some cases pretty indiscriminately major cities such as Kharkiv, which has been targeted. That's the second largest city in Ukraine and in the east right near the Russian border. This aid has got to get passed. It's got to get to the president's desk, and it's got to start filling up the pipeline once again because they're in a really tough spot. If they get that, and I think they will. It looks like Speaker Johnson is taking a courageous path to do the right thing here, even at some risk, of course, to his own position. But once that's done, if they can survive until that arrives, and I think they can, then I think they're going to be able to hold the lines, even in the face of an anticipated offensive that will start in June or so this summer by the Russians. If they don't get it, they're going to be in a very difficult position.
General David Petraeus, Thank you for your service. Thank you for everything you do. And we'll look to catch up again real soon.
Absolutely. And thanks for what you do, John.
You are listening to the Cats Roundtable. We'll be right back.
Hi, it's Lou Dobbs for Priority Gold, America's precious metals dealer. These are volatile times with high inflation, soaring debt, wars on multiple continents, and rising financial stress. Central banks are buying gold to diversify their reserves, so are many Americans. Call Priority Gold and find out how precious metals can help you diversify your portfolio. They're highly rated and happy to help. Call 1-866-303-6357 or get a free gold guide at PriorityGoldGuide.com. That's PriorityGoldGuide.com.
Welcome back to the Cats Roundtable.
Radio, radio, what would life be? What would life be without it?
With us today is Congressman Frank Pallone Jr., and he is the U.S. Representative from New Jersey, the 6th Congressional District. He just made a big deal, a bipartisan deal. It's good to hear the word bipartisan in Washington for a change. With Congresswoman...
Kathy Rogers, she's the chair of our committee.
That's it. And you are... She is... Kathy Rogers is the chair of the Energy and Commerce Committee, and you are the ranking member. Is that correct?
The ranking Democrat, yes.
Ranking
Chief Democrat.
Okay. A lot of the car companies wanted to get rid of AM radio. Both of you got together and say, this is not right. Would you tell our audience and tell all our people that are listening on AM radio why you did this and why this is not right?
Well, AM radio is extremely important, John, particularly during an emergency. So I remember when Sandy hit many years ago, the Superstorm Sandy, a lot of people at the Jersey Shore, which I represent, were you getting in their cars and turning on AM radio to find out information about the storm, where they could get gas, where they could get food, and they had no other access. The cellular towers were down. They had no TV. Just extremely important during an emergency. So when the auto manufacturers said they wanted to start doing this, they were going to initially say they weren't going to have AM radio as a standard feature in electric vehicles. But now we hear it may go beyond that to any new cars. And so we're basically saying in this legislation, bipartisan, that they have to include a device in all new cars, electric or not, that can take the signal from AM radio in any passenger vehicle, and that has to be a standard feature, which is not an additional cost.
Well, that sounds reasonable. I know that for a fact that if all the electronic systems go down, you'll still be able to get AM radio on your car radio. You can still get it on your transistor radio. It's a form of communications that's been going on forever. You know, the car companies, who knows? There must be more agendas than we know of. But I know they're lobbying very hard to get rid of AM radio and then probably FM radio. They want you to go right through their own electronic system, I guess.
Well, I mean, I think you're right. And the problem is that in an emergency, none of that's going to work. So, for example, they had like about 25% of the cellular towers were down during Sandy. So, I mean, this is a fact. We're not, you know, something not a guess. We know that, and you're getting to be more and more extreme weather conditions these days. So if you have another emergency and you don't have your AM radio in your car, you're going to have a problem. And that's why we want to make sure that they're included in the standard package.
I remember when we had the Northeast blackouts, everybody was hanging around in front of their cars listening into what's going on. Why, was it like 10 or 12 or 13 states that were out?
Oh, yeah. And then they would communicate over AM as to like where you could get gas, what supermarkets were still open. Basically, it was a lifeline, an emergency for all basic necessities.
Well, Frank Pallone, I commend you for getting together on bipartisan. And we, like I said, we need more bipartisan in Washington on that subject with the Congresswoman Rogers. What other things are bothering you that's going on right now that you're trying to fix?
Well, talk about bipartisan. Another issue right now is what I call data privacy. We had a hearing today, and this is where all these, you know, platforms, social media, Facebook, you name it, they all take your data and then they sell it. So they'll get your health data and sell it. They'll get your, you know, all kinds of information that's not necessary for your use of whatever they're selling. And so we have, again, Kathy Rogers and I have a bipartisan bill called National Privacy Act that would say that you cannot gather data when you use an app or whatever, unless that information is directly related to that business, whether you're buying or selling something. They can't collect your data and then sell it to somebody else. And again, this is bipartisan. And then we also have these data brokers, John. These are people that actually their only business is collecting your data, creating a portfolio, and then they sell that. And so we have other legislation that actually passed the House already bipartisan, actually unanimously. It's in the Senate now, that says that data brokers can't sell information to our adversaries like Beijing or Russia or North Korea or Iran, because this is what's happening now. You have these data brokers that basically gather all this information on you, and then they sell it, and they make a profit.
You were concerned as long as I was, too. I mean, I love whales, and I know another whale got along the Jersey Shore last week, and they were going to do an autopsy on it. People are blaming the windmills. Well, what say you? I really love whales.
We don't have any windmills. We don't have any windmills. The basic problem is vessel strikes. In other words, every time they've been able to do an autopsy on these whales, they find that they were struck pretty much always by either by some ship or by sometimes they get tangled in fishing gear. And this problem is going to get worse now because when the Key Bridge went down in Baltimore, John, all the traffic from Baltimore has now been changed. And most of it's coming up to the port of New York and New Jersey now and goes right through areas where the whales breed this time of year. So there's actually a federal rule that says that any ship that's over 65 feet has to slow down to 10 knots within these zones where the whales are. And we want to make sure that that's enforced, and particularly for the vessels that are coming now from Baltimore being detoured to New York Harbor, that they abide by it too. And that seems to be the major reason why we're having so many whales. They're coming closer to shore, and they're being hit by these large commercial vessels. So, I mean, that's the biggest issue right now when it comes to the whales and trying to prevent them from dying or being hit. I heard that NOAA, which, you know, deals with this, NOAA is the federal agency, there's only like maybe 10 or 20% of the time that they're enforcing these vessel speeds. You know, you can imagine that if a big cargo ship's coming into New York Harbor, you know, they want to get there as quickly as possible because every minute that they lose, you know, they lose money. But if they don't slow down, then they're going to hit the whales, and that's what's happening for the most part.
Well, Congressman, thank you for doing everything you do, and let's stay in touch and let's talk more.
All right, John. It's been a while. I haven't talked to you. I'm glad you had a chance today to call me, and we had this opportunity. Thanks.
Your name came up in Las Vegas, and you're famous in Las Vegas during the broadcast show that was going on.
All right.
Thank you so much.
You take care. Take care.
The Cats Roundtable.
With us today is my good friend and in-house genius, Dr. Peter Michalos. Our philosophy, live long and prosper. Dr. Peter Michalos, I'm glad everything's well with you. And what is today's advice, and how do we get to live to be 100?
Well, we're going to talk about a topic that's very important to everyone, and that's anti-aging and some of the tools that are being used in anti-aging and on the new frontier of medicine, which many times now in the age of in-and-out medicine and the short amount of time people spend with people, there are certain areas of medicine that people don't spend a lot of time to talk about. Today, we're going to talk about peptide therapy. One of the earliest peptides being used was actually insulin, and it's basically a group of amino acids that are chained together. But in the body, they have a very interesting process. They're like the activator switches. They work by stimulating various processes in our body, such as collagen production, which we need to heal for joints, for knees, growth hormone release. They also have been used in weight loss, like the semaglutides we know about, affecting how hungry we are, also regulating certain patterns, even how our sexual drive is, our energy levels. And for example, there's one peptide called BPC-157 that now many orthopedists are starting to use, and they find that it's helpful in the repair after trauma and orthopedic injuries. And they're also using it in certain gastrointestinal problems and and gut regulation problems with certain people who have stomach problems. So these peptides are being used more and more in anti-aging, after trauma, in hormonal regulation. And we're going to be hearing a lot more about these molecules. The problem is that a lot of these things, some of them are entangled in the FDA, and the FDA gives a lot of resistance to the use of these peptides, and they're being used throughout Europe and other countries in the Near East, Mideast, but getting them in the United States is a little bit harder, but they are, some of them are still available, but you really have to have first a good deep dive of blood work. After that, then your anti-aging integrative medicine specialist or even some orthopedist will prescribe some of these medicines, and we're going to be hearing about these things a lot more in our pursuit of longevity, anti-aging, getting our bodies to heal better and faster. And also the other thing is, as we talked about in the healing process and longevity, you have to have a lot of the basic amino acids, what are called essential amino acids. Those are the bricks and building blocks. And that's why it's important after surgery, why they advanced your diet and they tell you to eat healthy and have the essential amino acids. But those are the building blocks that help you heal. And one of the vitamins that helps glue everything together for collagen repair is vitamin C. And that's why they tell you after wounds and injury to take vitamin C. That's how it was first discovered when the British sailors, the reason they call them limeys is that they found that vitamin C, without it, their gums would bleed, they wouldn't heal, but then they would travel in transatlantic voyages without refrigeration with limes and lemons, and they'd put it in the water, and that's how they got their vitamin C, and they would heal better, and they would, their gums wouldn't bleed. So that's, vitamin C turns out to be a great glue to help heal our collagen, our skin. And our skin, of course, is the largest organ in our body, and it's our barrier to the outside world. So it's important to keep our skin healthy. And they even have peptide creams now that women are using and some men use for anti-aging as well. So we'll be hearing more about peptides on future episodes of the Cats Roundtable. Always consult your physician first before using any of these medicines.
That's a good lesson on staying alive longer and getting, keep staying healthy. All the things going on these days, is there's so many things going on with all new strange diseases, and anything that we should be concerned about?
Yeah, sure. Better sanitary conditions. When you have people walking around cities and urinating and defecating in the streets, guess what's happened? You're going back to the old days, where diseases spread more readily, and then you have disease carriers that ride in crowded places like cities and subways and crowded venues, and we're going to see more of disease spread. So we need to get back to good old-fashioned hygiene. We need to have clean streets, clean subway seats, clean bus seats, and, you know, good old-fashioned keep things clean, keeping our air, our surfaces clean to minimize the spread of disease. The proper screening mechanisms as people are coming in to the country, however, which way they come, that they get screened properly for medical issues before they merge with the rest of the population. And it's part of the health and safety to protect the public, the American people. And in every country, there are health and safety laws, but you need to follow them.
Dr. Peter Michalos, thank you for everything you do to keep our audience living longer. And we'll catch up with you again real soon.
Thank you, John, and thanks for always getting the truth out on the Cats Roundtable.
Thank you for listening to the Cats Roundtable. We'll be right back right after this break. Welcome back to the Cats Roundtable. If you ever miss a segment or want to hear it again, go to WABCRadio.com, go to podcasts, go to minicast, and play back your favorite segment. With us this morning is one of our most favorite segments. We have Steve Cates, otherwise known as Dr. Sky. He lets us, you know, look up in the skies and say, what's going on? Steve Cates, what is going on this week that'll give us a little bit of light?
Well, good morning, John, and happy Passover season to those listeners, of course, that celebrate the season. We talk about some things, John, now about space debris, space junk, and meteorites. This is all stuff in the news. And we find out about a week ago, space scientists report that debris from the International Space Station that was let go, meaning that there's a big pallet of material, a bunch of nickel hydrogen batteries about the size of an SUV called Pallet EP9. That's their technical name. So they expected the whole thing to deorbit over a period of a few years. Well, it sure did. The problem is, John, it didn't all disintegrate. So a gentleman down in Naples, Florida, Alejandro Ortero, he found out the hard way. One of those big gas cylinders came through the roof of his house, crashed through the floor, made a 2-foot crater in his house. Now, that's pretty spooky to say, especially about talking about debris from space, don't you think?
It went right through the roof. How far down did it go? All the way down the basement? Did it go even?
No, some say, I don't know for sure, but some say about 2 feet into the surface of the ground. So apparently, whatever his surface of the floor was, concrete or wood, well, I'll tell you what, that would have scared the bejeebers out of me, and I'm sure everybody else, because you don't expect something that was released years ago on the premise that it was going to burn up. People thought that that was a way to get rid of space debris, but being space is so crowded, that's a real strange phenomenon.
Does the insurance company pay, or is that an act of God?
Well, I think it's an act of God. They can get away with that, but I think it's going to change, because I'm sure many attorneys out there are going to start looking at ways that, who knows, with the preponderance of space debris, who knows? But we have another one that's weird, John. Here we go. Back on February 28th, we found out, because space is so crowded, that a Russian dead spy satellite called Cosmos 2221, it came, John, within 30 feet. Let me repeat that. 30 feet of an active NASA satellite that studies the sun and weather changes here on the Earth. Now, if those two collided, that would have been a disaster. It was space debris all over the place, like the movie that many people saw called Gravity, in which they depicted what would happen to the space station. But, John, here's another weird kind of angle on this. An aerospace scientist years ago, he defined something called the Kessler syndrome. Well, that means, John, if one of those satellites hits another, with all the space debris and the closeness of satellites, it could do this most amazing chain reaction of debris in the sky. Space is getting crowded, and that's an understatement.
I understand they tried to turn on one last time the helicopter on Mars?
They sure did, John. Unfortunately, one of the blades, if not more than that. I mean, this is a rotor system that's worked very well with all its flights. But unfortunately, that little craft is pretty much gone forever now into the history books. And that's amazing, because look at how far Mars is away, and you have to send these signals and look at the time delay. So Mars right now, about over 200 million miles, that signal takes time to get there. They tried, and unfortunately, nothing happened. So we look at the great legacy of this little drone on the surface of Mars. It paves the way for a lot more.
I understand, but, you know, Voyager sent back some wild or strange signals?
It sure has, and we're amazed that it even works. Because I mentioned this to you, or I've mentioned this to other people that we talk about with these things in the world of space. But the memory on this particular little spacecraft, this particular spacecraft, Voyager 1, only has 68 kilobytes of memory storage. So your cell phone has 240 times, you know, more memory than the little tiny spacecraft. But what was wrong? They say one of the chips, maybe 3% of its flight data system's computer, will have some kind of error. But, John, don't you think after that many years in space at 15 billion miles, I think they've gotten a lot of good results. The ROI on that spacecraft, I think, goes way over the top. I think that's pretty impressive.
Now, you have a mystery of the week.
John, we always have one, and we talk about the Egyptians. And they studied the Milky Way more than probably any civilization. And what they did, they actually had a goddess to the Milky Way in honor of her. Her name was Nut. And she obviously has this amazing story. And what's it in a nutshell? She basically, as she lied there in the heavens, she would, of course, watch the sun set. And she would give birth in the morning, as they talked about in the Egyptian in mythology. But what's so fascinating about this is that all the time that she spent, she was the watchful eye on the great star system, our Milky Way galaxy. So the Egyptians, with all the great science that they did, I don't think they missed anything. And that's amazing. She's the goddess of the sky. She's the goddess of the heavens, astronomy. These are amazing things. But what's the mystery about this? In other words, when and how did they even come up with these ideas? This is stuff that we don't know, and we're still learning from so many of the so-called books, even though they weren't in print form, of what the Egyptians did to consecrate their love of the nighttime sky and all of the things that they did with the mystery of the pyramids. And we both agree, John, it's amazing to even believe how did they move those big stones without help. They didn't have cranes or bulldozers. These are mysteries that we, of course, will continue to talk about.
One more thing. Next week is Passover.
Yes, it is.
What's the lunar connection to Passover and other April sky events?
Well, John, we found the full moon officially this month on the 23rd at 7:49 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. In Native American cultures, they called it this beautiful pink moon, like flowers growing. But in the Hebrew world, it's usually celebrated as the 15th day of the new month called Nisan, and we find out that that coincides with this particular full moon, as it does every time we look at the date of Passover. So simply, there's a great correlation, just like Easter, with things in the sky and the symbology of the heavens. But this one is tied very, very closely to the full moon. As I understand why, we begin Passover on the evening of the 22nd, and the great celebration continues from there. Just amazing stories and their connection to what we see in the heavens, the blinking above us. And John, as I always recommend, always go to the Dr. Sky Experience at WABCRadio.com for more details and information on all these subjects, astronomy, space, aviation, and weather. So thank you for having me, as always.
Steve Cates, thank you so much for entertaining us on Sunday mornings, and we'll catch up with you again real soon.
Thank you, John. Have a good day.
With us today is Andrew Stutterford, and he is with National Review. He talks about capital matters and new initiatives in the financial world. Today's discussion is electric vehicles. They're not having a good year. Is it a problem for them or a problem for the American people? Mr. Stutterford, is this the Edsel of the 21st century? What say you?
Is it I don't think it's quite the Edsel of the 21st century. But what it is not is a free market success story. Let's just put it that way. Henry Ford would not have approved of the way that this is being done. Henry Ford made a product that was an advance on what there had been before, and people wanted to buy it, and things moved on perfectly naturally from there. And that is not what is happening here, and that is the core of the problem.
I mean, I admire the guy from Toyota, the CEO of Toyota, when it says that I'm going to make electric cars, I'm going to make gas cars, I'm going to make diesel cars, I'm going to make hypercars. Let the consumer decide.
He was absolutely right. Mr. Toyota, who is the grandson of the founder, and he got in what he says is there must be many routes to electrification. Let the consumers decide, just like you said. He is obviously a little bit biased because they have made such a success of hybrid cars, but there's nothing wrong with hybrid cars. And he said, you know, let people choose, let people find their way, and you can carry on reducing carbon emissions. And he got in a lot of trouble for allegedly not pushing, he wasn't for pushing that hard for pure electric vehicles. And some investors, particularly American investors, got unhappy because he was also speaking out, which is not really allowed. So he was demoted, but in a very Japanese way. He was demoted by ceasing to be the CEO and becoming the chairman. He still has a lot of influence. And what we have seen since he was pushed up or down or sideways, however you want to put it, is that demand for hybrids has grown quite rapidly, and that the Toyota stock, particularly of late, has been doing very, very well. And now other companies are beginning to say, well, maybe we should be doing more on the hybrid side as well. And even Chinese consumers now, who are, of course, the great model of the EV, the electric vehicle market, they too are pouring into hybrids. This whole thing is an enormous exercise in capital destruction, and which could have been solved by letting consumers make their choice, letting this technology, which is right for the right people, you know, there's nothing wrong intrinsically with electric cars, but let people decide, let the consumers decide.
Any improvement over the next 10 years or 20 years, I mean, on batteries? It sounds like there's a tremendous problem on batteries.
there's a tremendous problem. Well, there are two tremendous problems. There are two main problems. One is charging and charging stations. As you know, it takes a very long time, even in the fast chargers. They're not really very fast to anyone who's used to changing the gas at a gas station. And then there's the question of the batteries themselves. The range, the figures that you get for range are not particularly accurate. Particularly if it gets cold, as we saw in Chicago, I think last time I was on the show, we talked about that. There are advances in battery technology. They are happening, and some of them may be actually pretty promising. But the best way to get technological improvement is by competition, unfettered competition. And if you say to the electric vehicle makers, if you say, okay, you have to make a better electric vehicle than your competitors, that's great, and people will improve, and they are improving. But it's much better to say you have got to compete against an alternative technology, an incumbent technology. That is the way that you're really going to get the improvements. And by basically beginning to squeeze out the makers of the conventional internal combustion engine vehicles, you are disincentivizing technological improvement. And that really is not the way to do things.
Thank you, Andrew Studdiford from National Review on your review of electric vehicles. And, you know, if I bought an electric car, the old-fashioned thing would be I'd use it on Sundays to go to church and back.
Exactly. And that's sort of what they're for.
Thank you so much, and we'll catch up with you again real soon. This is the Cats Roundtable. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Cats Roundtable. With us today is Steve Forbes, one of the smartest economists I know. And Mr. Forbes, our economy is floundering. What's going on?
What's going on is confused. One of the things, in addition to the huge spending, reckless spending from Washington, which is at a higher level than it was even at the height of COVID, nobody seems to know where that money is going, trillions of dollars. But one of the great dangers is the Federal Reserve, which still believes that the way you fight inflation is by depressing the economy. So the fact that the economy shows some signs of strength, the Fed is keeping interest rates at artificially high levels, and that's doing two things. One, it is hurting particularly people, middle and lower incomes, who have to pay interest on mortgages, who have to pay interest on credit cards, interest on car payments and the like. They're getting crushed. And then the housing market and the commercial real estate market are getting crushed as well when you have mortgage rates going up to 7.5%. As you know, the monthly payment for a typical house owner has doubled in the last couple of years from $1,000 a month to $2,000 a month. That is a real hit to Americans. And, John, one of the surprising things is that the Consumer Price Index does not include interest payments on mortgages or car loans or credit cards. Those are real expenses, but they're not included in inflation. If they did that, the real rate of inflation would be 2 to 3 times what it is announced today.
It seems like the higher the interest rates, the more problematic is going to be for the real estate industry, and then the banks will have a problem.
A lot of banks are going to have problems precisely because a lot of people, especially in commercial real estate, are not going to be able to make timely payments because of the high vacancy rates. And the housing market's been totally mucked up because people who have low fixed mortgage rates don't want to sell. And so you have artificial shortages. It's a real mess. And interest rates are a cost of doing business, which the Fed doesn't seem to realize. What the Fed should do is let the market set interest rates. What they're doing is a form of rent control with their interest rate manipulations.
What else is hurting our economy? What do you see?
What's hurting are the countless regulations that are coming in now that are especially burdensome to small businesses who don't have the lawyers and the accountants and others to deal with this rain of regulations. Even big banks are hit by it. For example, the large banks now have to file 2 reports, each 80,000 pages long, which are useless in terms of capital adequacy. If you want capital adequacy for a bank, just look at the balance sheet. But regulators are making them do these thousands of pages of regulations that are burdensome, raise the cost of living. For example, the head of J.P. Morgan, Jamie Dimon, pointed out the other day that if you took out all the crazy regulations on mortgages, they would be, the typical mortgage rate would be 70 to 80 basis points lower than they are today. So instead of 7, it would be 6.2. That's real money, and that is just useless regulation, imposing a real burden on real people.
Mr. Forbes, how are things going to happen when the individual agencies like the EPA are making their own rules? And already the Supreme Court says rules for business and for our economy, et cetera, are supposed to be done by Congress.
That's right.
How are
regulations
we going to fix that?
That have a certain impact have to be approved by Congress. And this is just the lawlessness of the current regime. They just do what they want to do, and the heck with what the law says. So when a new government takes over in January, one of the first things they have to do is get rid of these regulations, also prosecute the lawlessness. They know what they're doing is wrong, but they figure, take the courts forever to do it, and we're just going to do it for short-term political election gains. So lawlessness must be punished.
Anything else you want to tell the American people on a Sunday morning?
What we're going is we have two stark choices. Either we go in the direction we're in, where we're stymied and suffocated with regulations and higher taxes that are coming, or we get a new approach, the traditional approach of individual creativity, initiative, allowing businesses to be able to grow and prosper, banks being able to lend, patients being in control of health care, and the Federal Reserve realizing their task is a stable value for the dollar and not manipulating the economy. The Soviet Union showed manipulating the economy doesn't work, so back off. They are wrong every single time. Their economic models, no matter how elaborate, can't predict the future. Get over it. Let people be free again.
Mr. Steve Forbes, thank you so much for your input. We're all working hard for our country. Thank you so much.
Thank you, John. Keep up the good fight.
The Cats Roundtable.
With us this morning is Bob Pacopo. He worked for American International Group, otherwise known as AIG. He was in charge of the Global Marine and Energy Division. Good morning, Bob Pacopo. How are you?
Good. Good morning, John. It's a pleasure to be on with you.
Bob, I asked you to join a United Nuclear Group because I believed in you, and I think we both believe in that the next form of energy that's going to run America is going to be SMRs, small modular reactors that will replace oil over the next 30, 40 years. And I think you believe it too. And for our audience that doesn't know what we're talking about, is the same nuclear reactors that run nuclear submarines for the last 50 years will be transformed to land models that you will be able to use it in small municipalities of 500,000 people and above, maybe, and they're going to be called SMRs. You tell me what you believe and what your thoughts are.
John, I agree with you completely. I think the U.S. has gone off on the wrong tangent. They're going crazy building wind and solar. And at the end of the day, those are opportunistic capacities. If the sun shines, you want to get electricity that way, that's fine. If the wind's blowing, you want to get electricity that way, that's fine. The problem is, as we decrease coal usage in the United States, and by the way, the rest of the world's going in an opposite direction, especially the developing world, and that's primarily because of how cheap coal is. Coal is baseload capacity. That's the electricity we need 24/7.
And I understand China is building a new coal facility like one a week or two every week or something like that?
I believe they've got 61 under construction now. And basically, they are not clean coal plants. The U.S. has some of the cleanest coal plants, but that's a different topic. We really want to focus on the SMRs. You brought up nuclear submarines, and the nuclear navy is over 60 years old. The important thing on the nuclear navy side, and submarines are a big part of it, but if you look at an aircraft carrier that houses
over 5,000 sailors. It provides all the electricity, all the steam for heat, the steam to launch planes with the catapults. And the safety record has been exemplary. Now, most of the backlash on nuclear power in the United States has been fear of the unknown. Now, there are three major events that people focused on. One is Three Mile Island, and Three Mile Island was a human error. The automated systems immediately shut it down, and there were no dangerous radioactive leaks. The next one was Chernobyl. Chernobyl was a testament to Soviet technology. The Russians basically built nuclear power plants with no containment. If anybody has been around or read anything about nuclear power plants, our power plants in the United States have been designed to take a fully loaded passenger aircraft, including a full load of fuel, a direct hit, and not crack through the rebar and the cement. But when you look at the large-scale nuclear power plants that were built to date, they had one big problem. They were usually built for a load that would exist in 5, 10, 20 years out. And as we all saw when we had the energy crash in the United States, that load never developed. And while you are building for that future load, your current load is only servicing a small portion of the cost of the reactor. This is where small modular reactors came in. People started to downsize, our company started to downsize small modular reactors to fit the niche market. I'm a firm believer that when you hear somebody like President Biden wring his hands every time there's a disaster in Puerto Rico, Bermuda's going through this now. You look at the Caribbean, and John, you pointed to the fact that we want to get away from dirty oil-fired plants. Almost the entire Caribbean is dirty oil-fired plants. We want to do something. Let's do it on a worldwide basis. Let's try to marry up with somebody who makes a small modular reactor. And we can, in fact, do something about climate change. Wind and solar won't do it. Now,
the joke I tell, Bob Picoppo, is if you think that solar and wind is going to run this country, I'll sell you the Brooklyn Bridge.
Al Gore poisoned the well with people's minds, and it you're right, it cannot work. The other thing that's an anomaly in there, when you look at gas plants that people brought in, and the environmentalists kind of forced the hand on that, they brought gas in because it was cleaner than coal. Well, and now they want to kill gas. The problem with killing gas, if you don't have gas, you cannot effectively utilize wind and solar. You need that to load balance.
This is John Katz from TV's. If you want to hear the full interview, go to WABCradio.com. If you ever miss a segment or want to hear it again, go to WABCradio.com, go to podcasts, go to minicasts, and play back your favorite segment. Thank you for listening to the Cats Roundtable. Every Sunday morning, we'll bring you the latest in what's happening in our community, our country, and the world. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. Have a nice Sunday.